Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Liberty Weekly Podcast. I'm your host, as always, Patrick McFarlane. And joining me today is David from the Law of Liberty Podcast. How's it going, man?
It's going well. Just finishing up my spring break. Not excited to get back to classes, but it is what it is.
Yeah. I remember being there. So I start my new job on Tuesday, so I'm trying to gear up myself for that mentally.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
So I was just on your show like a week or two ago, right?
Something like that, yeah.
Do you want to tell, I haven't dropped that in my podcast feed yet, but I'll link it in the episode description for this. I'd like to do that maybe before this drops, but.
Yeah, you're welcome to cross post it.
That'll get you some ear holes for you. But do you want to just tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your show and your co-host?
Yeah, I'm Dave. I'm a third-year law student about to graduate and go work in public interest. I started this podcast with my co-host Stratty, who does Insurrection Inc. podcast with Porter and Jay and those guys. And we met at Mises University, and he convinced me to do a show because we really hit it off and became friends. And he wanted to do something a little bit more, you know, like scholastic than the other podcast he was doing. So we decided to team up, and we've about 20 episodes deep at this point. So we're enjoying it.
Yeah. And you've had some awesome guests too in content. So everyone should go check that out for sure. And is Stratty a law student?
He's not. He's a little bit younger than me, actually. He just turned 20. So yeah, but he's not a law student. No.
Okay. So you kind of, you get the two angles then, I suppose.
Yeah, that was kind of the hope, was that him not being legally trained, if I can explain these things in a way that, you know, makes it understandable to him. Because that's one of the problems that I think there is with the law, is that it's so insulated, and there's these Latin terms that only we know, and there's this lingo. It's like an insider boys club. And I really don't like that, because it affects everybody's lives. And so that was one of the things we were hoping to do with the show, was to kind of talk about libertarian legal theory, but put it in a way that even if you're not a legal scholar, or, you know, you can still understand it. And I think that's really important, something to strive for in the law that gets overlooked.
It is. And you and I discussed this in the episode that we did on your show, was I've said on my show that it's like being able to read the code in the Matrix is having an understanding of these legal principles.
Yeah.
I mean, I was telling you, we just sold our house, and we were going through the offers to purchase and everything like that. And I just thought I would have, if I didn't have my law degree, I'd have much harder time figuring that out. And I mean, could you imagine going through that process without knowing like the basics of contract law?
No, it'd be a nightmare.
Yeah.
And there's just so much trust that you have to put in your lawyer. And in a certain sense, you know, that's always going to be the case. And that's why we have professional ethics. But, you know, it's just, it sucks. It sucks that the regular common person can't understand a lot of these stuffs. And to a certain degree, I think that's by design. You know, I think there's definitely a lot that goes on, you know, especially, and not only with the, you know, having regular people be able to understand it, but also just barriers to entry to becoming a lawyer, and, you know, the monopoly bars and stuff, having complete control over licensure and stuff. It's definitely very insulated, and it's a problem.
It's kind of one of those things, isn't it? Where like the Federal Reserve is that the Bar Association is a private entity, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, it might be different state to state. Some states might have it be a chartered thing, but I think in a lot of states, yeah, it's just a private professional organization, but granted powers by the state, of course.
Exactly. Yeah. So, well, I don't want to bury the lead here, but just so everyone knows, we're going to go over this paper by Murray Rothbard entitled "Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution," and this was published in the Cato Journals. Is that right? I think it is. Cato Journal, Volume 2, Number 1, Spring 1982.
Right.
So, but yeah, man, just to go off what you were saying, I think I've talked about that on the show before, but one of my favorite things about Lysander Spooner is that his first act as an attorney was to sue for his bar admittance.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, that just goes along with who he was as a person.
Yeah, I need to learn more about him. I mean, I understand some of his basic arguments and constitutional law arguments and stuff. I know he tried to make a private post office and got nailed for that, but I didn't know about that.
Bombardments. Well, I'll toot my own horn here. Back when I first started the show, I did a biographical episode on him, so I'll have to drop that in the show notes page, but... He's a badass. It was like there was a law in, I don't remember which state he practiced in, and I'm sure someone listening will know.
From Massachusetts, wasn't he?
Okay, it must have been that. I was gonna say someone in the comments will be screaming to themselves, I know this, but So he, I think what it was is that he was working under another attorney for the requisite number of years, but he never went to law school, if I remember that correctly. So, I mean, talk about huge barrier to entry for folks who aren't able to pay for school or don't have, you know, the means to do that.
But have a decent education by actually working in the field.
Mm-hmm. And the law is one of those things where, I don't know about you, but I don't think you actually have to go to law school to be a good lawyer.
I don't feel prepared at all. Like, yeah. I feel like I know a lot of information about the law itself. But there's actually something I wanted to talk with you about, and hopefully we can maybe bridge into it during our Rothbard discussion. But it's like, I definitely have a lot of questions for someone like you who has actually practiced and like the actual way this works out, you know, because it's like, I said, I know these laws, I know these rules, I learned these doctrines, but the actual nuts and bolts, the wheels turning, as it were, of a courtroom. I mean, I've seen some of it, but you know, I know next to nothing. And I feel like that's the next big learning hurdle that I have to go through. And law school, in a lot of ways, unless you do like, you know, unless you're really, really smart and you get on like the mock trial team or whatever like that, some of that experience of doing a trial and stuff gets lost on it. And I didn't do that stuff, you know, so hopefully it's not too much of a learning curve once I first start, but I know that it will be at least a little bit of a learning curve.
It will. And I mean, when you graduate from law school, you think that you, you're like, oh, I did it. I passed the bar. You know, I'm ready. All the heavy lifting is done in a certain way. Cause you're like, oh, cause when you're in law school, you're just like, oh, all I need to do is think, you know, one day at a time, one week at a time, finish the bar exam and do all that stuff and get admitted to practice. But then it's like, no, actually, it's a whole different gear. Yeah. And I think I thought that to myself, but I was trying not to.
Yeah. At least I'm glad that I'm not disillusioned as to that fact. I'm glad that it's something that I recognize. But, you know, it's tough. It's like, I know that there's something that I'm expecting, but I don't know exactly what I'm expecting. I just know that there's something that I'm expecting. So it's like, it's a little bit better to prepare because I know that something crazy is going to happen, but I don't know how to prepare or what's really going to happen. So
yeah,
at least I have a good idea about what I want to do. I have a job lined up and I want to try to turn that job into something more full-time in the same area. So, you know, that's the start. And then I just go into it with an open mind, treat it as a learning experience. Hopefully, before too long, I'll learn everything else I need to learn that law school, unfortunately, leaves out.
It's super normal. I mean, that feeling is super normal. And, I mean, does it remind you of the feeling that you had before you were a 1L?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember, I think I might have, I've mentioned this a few times on the show, but I really did not start to, like, connect dots with everything until I was in maybe almost halfway through my second year. I took remedies way too early. I took remedies the first semester of my second year, and I did not know enough about other things to really get as much out of that class as I should have. I still learned a lot, but it's just like, it's so many different.
Oh, I think you're frozen here, but one, just for the audience's sake, if we get you back, remedies is basically, it's kind of like damage. Okay. I got your audio there. Are you back?
Yes, I am.
Okay. For people who don't know what remedies is, it's basically like damages class, right? It's like, okay, we won the case. Now what?
What am I owed? What's my just due?
Yeah.
And so, like, there's so many different, like, you'll be reading one section and it'll be contract cases. And then the next section will be all tort cases. And then the next section will be, you know, a mixture of both or an insurance case. You know, it's just like all these different substantive areas of law. And so, you know, not knowing so much about those kind of hampered my ability to understand, well, why the heck are we giving this remedy that we're giving? Because I kind of didn't understand some of the substantive things underlying it. So I still learned a lot for sure. Don't get me wrong. But I kind of wish I would have taken remedies my third year. So if there's anybody listening who's planning on law school, that might be one thing I'd suggest is wait until a little bit later to get into remedies, because I just felt like every single day, those first year and a half, I was like absorbing information and learning new things, but it was just kind of like individual bits and pieces. And then the bigger picture really didn't start to come to my view until afterwards. And now I'm starting to get a little bit more of an idea of like how the bigger picture works. But like I said, there's still so much more for me to learn because I know kind of the substantive picture, but not really the procedural, mechanical, actual feet on the ground, lawyering, you know, side of things. And that's just as important, if not more important in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah. And well, I would suggest that everyone listen to our first episode, whether I drop it in the feed after this, because I don't want this to get stale, but I really enjoyed that conversation and there's so much meat there. Like if people listen to my conversation with Dean, an episode that came out a couple weeks ago, it's just as good as that one. That was a great one too. So let's get into the paper here. I'm going to try and see if I can't screen share it. Oh, well, that's fine. I got it. I'm recording here. But so on my recording here, people can see the paper. The first off here, man, I mean,
check it out. I just allowed you to share.
Oh, you did. Okay. Mm-hmm. We'll do that. So here we go. Can you see on the screen here?
Yeah. It's kind of blown up though.
Too big?
Yeah.
Okay. How's that?
No, it's still like, no.
How's that?
I just see the top left corner of the paper.
Oh. Well, at least on my screen, people can see it.
Okay.
Oh, and they can see us in the corner too.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so here kind of Rothbard talks about just exactly kind of what the law is. And the way he kind of sets it out is that law is a set of commands. The principles of tort and criminal law are negative commands or prohibitions on the order of thou shalt not do actions. And I mean, that's the libertarian ethic, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is a good, really strong foundation. And this is probably, I think, what's the strongest stuff in the paper. At least I read about half of it. Before coming in here, I've read the whole thing in the past, but for this episode, I read about half of it. And this is the stuff I think is the strongest because it's very grounded in, you know, the homesteading principle. He talks a little bit more about that later, but, you know, violent aggression, the initiation of force, and the fact that the law is a set of normative commands, which is really true. He's kind of pushing back against the Langdellian kind of science of law type of view, right? And this is a big like idea for people who don't know. Langdell was the dean of Harvard Law School, right? Like back at the early 20th century or something like that, around that time period. And he really kind of came up with this idea of like law as a science. We go out and we like test, we look at cases, collect empirical data, and we draw out principles from that. And Rothbard is completely rejecting this here. He's like, no, like the idea of law is normative, philosophical, deductive. It's not about empirically testing things, right? And so he's kind of trying to bring back law into the realm of ethics rather than trying to scientize it as, you know, same thing happened to economics, right? They try to treat economics like a physical science with empirical testing rather than deductive. So I think that's really an awesome point that he's making here.
And it really seems to me like he's also pushing against the Chicago school. And I know that there's been some interesting interplay between David Friedman and Murray Rothbard himself. Let's see, I just realized what was wrong with the screen, and I realized that you wouldn't be able to see it. How's that?
There we go.
Okay, yeah. So, I mean, he was really pushing back against, this time David Friedman was practicing, and I think he was a law professor. But it seems like he's really pressing back against this utilitarian approach, where in the first chapter he uses this analogy about, I'm trying to find it here on the screen, this analogy about the railroad company, and where the Chicago School would basically use a utilitarian approach about, you know, when there's conflicting rights, which one gets the preference.
Right.
And Rothbard uses the same analogy to illustrate that, you know, there's this feeling about the sentimental value of a land. So are you in a good position to kind of lay out this hypo?
I think so. I mean, basically it's the Coase theorem, right? He's basically just saying, look, there's this railroad which is emitting sparks and it's damaging the hay on the farm. And he just goes through kind of the Coase theorem idea of, well, it's worth this much to this guy and this much to the other guy. And the court compares the two. And basically they say that if transaction costs are zero, then it doesn't matter who you give the right to, right? Because they will bargain to give it to the person who values it more in the absence of these transaction costs. But then, given that we have transaction costs, the Coase lesson from the Coase theorem is that the court should evaluate who values it more and give it to that person who, if there had been no transaction costs, would have gotten it. And Rothbard says that this is economically absurd because it requires interpersonal comparisons of utility, ideas of social cost, the ideas that money is value, which money isn't value. Money is a tool. It has value, but value is subjective, ultimately in the mind. So he just kind of lays out some of these absurdities and contradictions in the Coase theorem and the Coase lesson to try to say, no, like this utilitarian approach, this way of looking at transaction costs, it's not right. So he's like using a good Austrian framework to kind of set up how we should go about thinking about allocating resources with law. So it's interesting. And I think he's right.
Go ahead. Say that again. Sorry.
I just think he's right. I think the Coase theorem is theoretically flawed. And I think Rothbard hits the nail on the head.
In my practice, at least, this is something that I've found to be this idea that, okay, well, you can have damages that are like prohibitions to do something like, what is that, estoppel or, no, it's, well, estoppel, but also like a restraining order to prevent something from happening.
An injunction?
An injunction. And you could have like, you can have direct performance, although the courts don't like to do that. And I don't think it's very libertarian.
No.
And that's the reason why courts don't like to do it, where direct performance would be forcing someone to do something.
It's a different way to address slavery.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Slavery too. Anyway, go on.
Well, basically, and that's where we were talking earlier about Rothbard's contract theory, the Evers-Rothbard contract theory. You can only contract for alienable property and not for direct performance or anything like that. But in this instance, at least in my practice doing personal injury law, the damages, the monetary damages for harm are not what people want, essentially. It's like, okay, well, I want my leg to be fixed.
Yeah.
Or in this case with the railroad analogy, it's like, okay, well, the guy who owns the farm, he might value that farm. It has sentimental value to him. But moreover, this idea of diminishing marginal utility, you know, Menger's idea that, well, the farmer only has one farm. The railroad company as an entity has lots of locomotives. It has lots of rail lines. It has lots of money. That doesn't mean to say that, you know, we should evaluate things based on equity or, you know what I mean? But, or maybe it does. What do you think?
Well, There's a few things. I guess one of the things I'm thinking is that another way you can kind of take down the Coase theorem is this kind of idea of one of the important things with law is certainty. And sometimes I do think that there is something to be said for, even if we have a rule, even if it's not a perfect rule, maybe even if it's a bad rule, sometimes, you know, given the strictures of life and just practicality, it's good to have something that's certain. You can guess, hey, this is how it's going to work. Maybe it's not the best way, but at least I can plan my affairs around a certain way that the law is going to operate. With the Coase theorem, it kind of undercuts that because it's just saying, hey, a latecomer could show up and take your property from you if somehow through some, you know, BS economic sophistry or whatever, say that they value your land more than you do, right? And I think that's a problem because as Hoppe talks about in like his homesteading theory and the way he really, you know, he really crystallizes Rothbard's homestead ideas and I think makes them better. And one of the things he talks about is how if you're not certain in your property when you homestead it or contract for it, you're not going to ever do anything. You're not going to homestead because you're not going to feel certain in that, right? And so that's why we have law, to create some kind of certainty that what you're using your property for or the property that you homestead or contract for, you're going to feel secure in that and you're going to know how the law is going to interpret your actions with it and so on. And I think the Coase theorem just kind of undercuts that. And, you know, I will say the law needs to be flexible. You know, certainty is not an end-all goal, but it's just a factor to consider.
And if I remember correctly, Hoppe talks about that in the theory of socialism and capitalism primarily. That's one of his main critiques of socialism is that, you know, all things being equal, if someone doesn't have control over their land, you know, if there's no scarcity or if someone doesn't have control over their own property, the incentive to invest in that property goes away. And it has a tendency, he says, to turn philosophers into drunkards.
Yeah. And so if you want, so the Coase is like trying to say, hey, this will give us more efficiency and this will be better. And then it's like, no, that loss of certainty, that loss of integrity in one's property based on the homesteading principle, that would very likely lead to more economic deprivation, less efficiency because of less economic growth. But it's a counterfactual. You couldn't test that because that's a reality that doesn't exist. There's no empirical test to be made there. So that's why we need the deductive theory. And Hoppe, Rothbard, they just point out that homestead, what other principle are you going to use to establish property rights? There is no other, because any other just leads to conflict. And the whole point of law is to resolve conflicts. So
the greatest irony that I just thought about here is that, well, aren't Austrians accused of thinking that macroeconomics doesn't exist?
I was actually just thinking about this last night, and I think in a sense the answer is yes, but the problem with the classic micro-macro distinction is that they treat it like there's different principles.
Right, yeah.
And the Austrians say, no, the same principles are at play, but it's just a separate level of abstraction, right? So you have to understand the micro to understand the macro. Whereas with the neoclassical kind of Keynesian or whatever way, that's not quite so the case. There are different baseline principles that apply to the macro and the micro, and that's absurd. I mean, it's out of line with everything we understand about like human nature. I mean, there are no collectives and there is no macro without the micro. You know, it's like trying to explain how galaxies work without understanding the basics of physics or atoms and stuff. I mean, it's just like, you know, obviously there's different ways things work at different levels, but to say that the baseline is totally different, I think it falls apart.
Well, I think the reason why I thought of this is because the Coase theory basically, I don't know, Austrians are accused of not being able, you know, that we focus too much on the micro, but here it's the Austrians focusing on the macro effect of, you know, what are the incentives of the system here?
Yeah, I think that's important too. I think looking at things as incentives is really good, but you know, you also fall into the trap of, you know, you know, what should really be the role of what we're doing when we're judging cases and stuff? I mean, it's like, should we be worrying about social policy? Should we be worrying about incentives of stuff? Or should we, you know, try to rule on this one specific case, right? Because worrying about how this one case might apply in the future could maybe take away your eyes from what's the just result here, you know? And I think one of the problems there is like the over-reliance on precedent, you know? I think that it leads to them worrying about, well, how will this affect cases in the future? Well, it's like, yeah, we might want some effect on cases in the future if this is a good ruling and similar cases come up. But we also want to be able to look at past cases and say, hey, you know, this doesn't apply to this case, you know? And sometimes they just say, well, this is what the past case ruled and therefore we're going to stick to it and not consider, you know, other things. So I don't know. It's a tough balance of like trying to do justice in the specific case, but then also worrying about what will the long-term ramifications of this policy be. And I don't know where the line is there, especially from a libertarian view.
Well, I think that's the point where you need good jurists and good attorneys to be able to differentiate and to distinguish cases and say, you know, well, maybe that's what the past precedent was, but we can distinguish this case in A, B, and C way.
Yeah.
But then you kind of get into the minutiae of it. But a great segue into this quote that I have highlighted here. And I don't know if this was before we went on air, but I was saying that I've studied Rothbard a whole bunch in everything except for law. And so you pointed this paper out to me, and I think it's good because this passage uniquely bristled me in a way that this is exactly, you know, well, I guess as a conservative jurist, I was a member, I was the vice president of the Federalist Society yeah. at my law school. So he says here, since the law is ultimately a set of normative commands, the true jurist or legal philosopher has not completed his task unless he sets forth what the law should be, difficult though that might be. If he does not, then he necessarily abdicates his task in favor of individuals or groups untrained in legal principles who may lay down their commands by sheer fiat and arbitrary caprice. So if you understand, and the reason why we're both laughing right now is because the Federalist Society, which is the more conservative traditional constitutionalist association in the legal field, states emphatically that a judge's law is to say, or a judge's role is to say what the law is and not what it should be. And this is wrapped up in separation of powers. So,
well, you know, this also wraps up in the difference between federal and state and common law and stuff, right? And this is a point Kinsella has made where he said that like federal justices, there's no federal common law for the most part. There's some maritime, one or two other things maybe, but for the most part, there's no common law in the federal system. And so they're basically just interpreting statutes. And, you know, it's not, I mean, they call them justices, but are they really trying to do justice? No, they're just interpreting statutory texts to try to say what the legislature wanted. They're not concerned with justice for the most part in a lot of the times. So, you know, it's a weird kind of thing where it's in the common law. And I think this also ties back in with something you brought up, equity, you know, and like how, you know, should we consider equity justice in cases? And the common law accepted that. The common law accepted that in cases you should consider stuff like that. What is the just result? What is fair? What is the normative good result here? How can we do justice in this case? And it saves us from armchair reasoning. It saves us from thinking like legislatures do, oh, how are we going to set up this big grand social policy and we can do all this economic and statistical analysis and know how it's going to change people's behavior? You know, it's like, no, let's get it down to a specific conflict between specific people so we can see how things are actually playing out in the real world and come to a just result. And if this is a problem that is coming up a lot more often, they can look to the case and say, hey, this was a good result. We'll follow it. If things change, they will reject it. And so, yeah, I think that's a huge thing. And I've made this quote in a few different papers I've written for law school. And I think it's key. You know, I really do agree with it that the right judge, the correct role of the judge is to look at the law, look at the way things have happened in the past, look at custom, and try to say, okay, we're going to look at this. This is the way things go. This is what persons may be contracted to based on the community they're living in. But also, what is the just result? What's, you know, what's the right thing to do? And the Federalist Society, for their values, I think gets it wrong there. I really do.
Yeah, and I think that's because they just get so wedded to this concept of constitutionalism.
Well, the rule of law, too.
Right, yeah.
Which I just recently read the Hazenass article, and it blew my mind. And in a way, it's even kind of like, it's even causing me to push back on some of the things Rothbard says in this paper, because he kind of seems to still have this natural law kind of view that there is a just law out there, right? Or there's something like that. And in a way, I think that's true, because I accept the Homestead theory for the reasons, you know, Hoppe and other people lay out. But at the same time, it's like, think of it like this. I had a discussion with a guy who was in my Discord, the Law of Liberty Discord. And he kind of couldn't wrap his brain around the idea of like implied contracts, right? And so the idea I was trying to show was like, okay, look, if somebody comes up to your house, right, and you don't say anything to them, they don't say anything to you, and then they pick a tomato off of your tomato branch, you know, they put it in their bag, they look at you, you don't, like, no expression, whatever, they just look at you, put it in the bag, and then leave. And then the next day they come back, do it again, and then leave. The next day they come back, do it again, and leave. And then a year down the line, you sue them for backwards damages of a year's worth of theft and punitive damages and whatever. You know, I think, no, it's like, you let them come onto your property. You didn't call the police authorities. You didn't tell them to stop. There's no evidence here of any coercion. I mean, if there was some threat or something, then that would change the things. But under this hypo, we don't have any of that. So it's like, you know, understanding reasonableness, understanding the context of the things like that, you know, it's like, just because someone came onto your property and took something of yours doesn't necessarily mean it was aggression. It always happens in a context. It always happens in a social kind of thing. And we need to understand that to figure out what actually is and isn't aggression, right? Because in one context, the very exact same action, you know, punching somebody, that might be aggression in one context, but it wouldn't be aggression in another context, like a boxing match. So I think Rothbard in this paper, I don't know, he seems a little too strict in some places, especially when a little bit later he starts to push back against the reasonable man standard and stuff. I don't know. I don't know if I'm fully prepared to get rid of that. And he seems to apply it differently in the liability versus the burden of proof context. He fully rejects it in the liability context, a little bit less so in the burden of proof context. But I don't know. I'm not sure I agree. I think there's something to be said about context and reasonableness about whether or not something was an aggressive act or not.
My thought about that is wondering if we are not just a product of our professional school system, like that we've been so, you know, ingrained with, okay, my first class in law school was torts. And I remember one of the first concepts we learned was the reasonable prudent person standard. And so in my lizard brain, this is so ingrained in it that my very base conception of law is wedded to the reasonably prudent person standard. So for folks who aren't familiar with this, I don't know if I've discussed it in the past, but the reasonably prudent person standard, well, this is a great segue to the other part of the paper.
Yeah.
But when judging whether a person is liable or whether a person has been negligent, not Rothbard, but the court uses this standard called the reasonably prudent person standard to judge if a, and the example that he uses is there's a case where a shopkeeper was confronting a dangerous crowd, a riotous crowd. And a police officer comes up and offers help to the shopkeeper, but the shopkeeper does not identify this person as a police officer and ends up shooting him.
Yeah.
So the trial court got the case right, according to Rothbard, is that, help me out here a little bit.
The cop who is in plain clothes walks up to the store or the house where the defendant was, and then he was going to render aid because there was a riot going on. And then the defendant plugs the cop who's in plain clothes, but he's walking through a riotous block of people to approach the house. And so basically Rothbard says that, look, the basis of tort is an invasion of person or property. So it doesn't matter whether or not you were reasonable in the way you invaded somebody's person or property. The fact that you did it is a tort. Now, maybe you were justified. Maybe we can reduce your punishment because you shot this guy when he came up to you, right? In a riot. And it was like, what did he expect? You know, what is he going to expect when he walks up to your place without identifying himself in some way, without holding up a white flag, you know, peace, you know? So it's a very radical, very strong take here. And so I get it. I mean, I think there's two kind of places my mind is going, either to reject this argument that he's making and to accept the reasonable man standard, or to think of it like, okay, maybe he's right in like theory, but then when we get to the punishment stage, we'll just say, well, yeah, you committed this tort. You shot this guy. It was an invasion of his person and his property, but you know, he was the way he was acting, you know, maybe we move the reasonableness not to necessarily liability, but to the punishment stage, right? And say, yeah, okay, we'll give you a reduced sentence because, you know, you were justified in doing it, or, you know, you were reasonably fearful, or he wasn't acting reasonably by approaching you in this situation, right? So I think maybe that would work, but in a way, maybe that's kind of a cop-out. I don't know. What do you think?
I mean, to me, we're really kind of getting in the difference between civil and criminal law. And I know that Rothbard would get rid of the distinction between the two and say that everything is tort. Because technically, when you are enforcing a civil judgment, you're committing aggression against someone unless you're justified, you know, in your verdict or in your remedy. See, where it doesn't comport either is, in my mind, where I did an episode with Kyle Anzalone a long time ago talking about FBI entrapment schemes, and I'd have to pull up the reference from antiquity here, but essentially, I mean, the classical criminal law under, you know, the classical theory of criminal law going back to the Enlightenment times is that, well, it really matters what, you know, this concept of mens rea is. What is the state of mind of the perpetrator? And if you're going with Rothbard's view of it, then we throw that all out of the window too. And on the other hand, this classical view of criminal law, where we look at the individual case and we have all these factors about the individual perpetrator, the defendant, that has kind of gone into a progressive mindset where everything's empirical. We'll plug all these factors into a formula and make it cold and calculating and spit out a punishment.
Yeah, like the learned hand formula.
Right, yeah. But that applies to tort law, right?
Yes, that's products liability.
Okay, and just so everyone understands, it's been more recent since you've studied this than me. But essentially, it's an empirical formula to determine, is it liability in maritime cases?
I don't know about maritime.
It had to do with a ship, didn't it?
Oh, that's right. The ship that was docking, and then it during the storm, right?
Yeah.
And it knocked up against the dock, and then the dock owner sued the boat owner for the damages. I don't know if it was a maritime case particularly, but it was like you balance the risk of harm, the social benefit, you know, the one or two other factors. And I have a problem with that because, like we kind of talked about before, this is kind of falling back into the Coase theorem trap, right? Where you're kind of balancing the way, right, you know, balancing the social utilities and factors, and it gets us ungrounded from a good solid basis in human nature and property, which, you know, the Austrians give us. So I think I'm happy to kind of get rid of that kind of stuff. But I don't think that's the same as saying, you know, I don't think that's the same as like a reasonable person standard. I don't think that's the same as saying, look, this guy's lived in this community for 25 years. How do people act in this community, right? If you don't walk up to other people's houses and you walk up to somebody's house in this community, then if, and Rothbard even says this later, he's very, very harsh on looters and trespassers on property. And so it's like, you know, if somebody in a certain community does that when it's not normally accepted, then that person would be justified. But if somebody walks up to your house and every single day you live in a little neighborhood and, you know, people walk up and say, hey, Joe, I'm having a barbecue, you know, come on over, you know, I don't think that's an act of aggression, but the action is the same. It's somebody walking onto your property, up to your house and knocking on the door. The same action, but a different, you know, a different context, and therefore leads to the same action being aggression or non-aggression in a different time and place. So I think that to figure out what it is, whether or not it's aggression, you need to understand, you know, what do reasonable people do in this context? So, you know, I don't know. Like I said, maybe you can move it away from the liability portion and into the punishment portion. And maybe that saves Rothbard's what he's trying to do here. Because I'm not totally unsympathetic. I mean, if somebody gets shot, and he also brings up innocent bystanders, right? Like if an innocent bystander gets shot, I think that's totally legitimate for the person who shot him was trying to defend themselves, but they accidentally shot another person because the perp ducked or whatever, right? Well, I think that the perp is the one who murdered the innocent bystander, not the guy who was reasonably defending himself. But Rothbard seems to say, no, you shot the guy, even though you were reasonably defending yourself, you shot him and you're liable. And, liable? You know, even if he is liable, definitely give him a lesser punishment, but liable?
Right.
I don't know. I think it's the perp who's liable. The perp was the one who was trespassing. The perp was the one who was threatening. He's the one who caused the chain of events. And that ties into strict causation that he talks about in the paper too. So I think there's some good insights here, but I'm not sure it totally works. It seems a little half-baked.
Yeah. And I think this is really important because I've criticized Rothbard before.
He's the guru. He's the man.
Of course he is. Yes. I said I had to show off my Rothbard t-shirt that I designed at some point in the episode. But I did the pixelated version of the famous Rothbard picture. So you can get that at libertyweekly.net/Rothbard. Anyways, you know, we were just talking about barriers to entry in the legal profession and this idea that it's some esoteric field that we have a complete monopoly on because we went to law school. But I wonder if Rothbard, I don't want to go into saying he's wrong because he's not a lawyer. But, what do you think?
Well, I mean, Kinsella did a talk at the Property Freedom Society on the contract theory. And one of the things he said was the fact that Evers and Rothbard achieved so much with their contract theory, not having been legal scholars, is, he said, in his words, he says, to my mind, is astonishing. That's the word he said. It's astonishing that they were able to come up with such a good contract theory without having been legal scholars. And so I in a sense, I agree with you. It's like, because the law is so complex and there's so much there that I think that some of the Austrians will, you know, suffer from a lack of understanding of the law. And I think that that was kind of what was going on with Rothbard. But I also think that a lot of lawyers lack an understanding of Austrian economics.
Right.
And I really, in a way, because the two are so inextricably linked in my mind, I have a really hard time separating the two. And because, you know, Austrian economics is all about human action and law is all about regulating human action and what is justified and what is unjustified, you know? So I think they go hand in hand, and to the extent that they miss out on each other, we make some errors in our logical trains.
In one way, I do wonder if Rothbard would have benefited from, you know, 10 years of practice in a law firm.
Yeah. Well, this is also what Joe Becker talked about. So, are you familiar with Joe Becker?
No.
Okay. So Joe Becker, he works at the Mises Institute. He used to be a public interest attorney. He worked at Mountain State Legal in Denver, I think it is. And he also worked at another place in Reno. But he also worked he was chief legislative counsel or something for Ron Paul when he was on the Hill. So he worked for Ron Paul, and he was talking about, he studied with Rothbard at UNLV. He got his master's in econ there.
Oh, yeah. Too.
Both of them were on his on his master's thesis committee. So
wow,
he talked about how he was working for a telecom company for a few years, and basically this telecom company had bought up some land or something to put up some structures, and it was going through a mobile home, so they had to, you know, they were going to end the mobile home and get the people out. And there was some law on the books in Nevada, I think it was, that said that you had to give people a certain amount of time notice or whatever. And then he said that he was telling Murray about this. And then Rothbard goes, they're mobile homes. They're by definition mobile. Just move them out. Why do you got to give them this time? You know? And then Joe's just like, you know, Joe himself said he had some really great theoretical insights, but, you know, he probably wouldn't have been a good legal practitioner. And I think that's probably true. And, you know, not necessarily to his, I mean, he wouldn't have been who he was, you know, if he had done that. So, the grass is always greener, as it were. But no, I think in some ways, yeah, he missed out on some insights without having a formal legal education.
Yeah. Well, and that's a good segue. Well, okay. So I wanted to talk about this hypothetical right now. This is a whole can of worms, man. So in an episode earlier, I think it was episode 88, libertyweekly.net/88, I was talking about how my parents have a house on the lake, and the neighbor moved out and sold his house to a hockey player who turned the house into a VRBO. And my parents were furious about this because he would rent the place out to people who would party every single weekend and who were obnoxious. And so Rothbard talks about this, essentially, talks about how no one has the right to legally prevent or retaliate against harms to his property unless it is an act of physical invasion. Everyone has the right to have the physical integrity of his property inviolate. No one has the right to protect the value of his property, for that value is purely the reflection of what people are willing to pay for it. That willingness solely depends on how they decide to use their money. No one can have a right to someone else's money unless that other person had previously contracted to transfer it to him. So he says, in the law of torts, harm is generally treated as a physical invasion of person or property. So what do you think, man, if in my hypothetical real world use case scenario, is the neighbor exercising his property rights to rent out the property, but the people he rents it to are, you know, it's a different person every weekend, and they party and they drink and they scream and holler and stuff. Is there a physical invasion happening?
Well, I think this is probably a nuisance case, right?
Yeah.
I would just be a nuisance. I mean, Rothbard even himself covers this later when he talks about an airport. And he says, if there's an airport that builds and there's no other residential areas around, then they have, in a sense, homesteaded an easement to a certain amount of decibels of noise pollution in the area, right? And I think that's kind of true. I think this is another thing that other non-lawyer libertarians miss, is like the idea of property as a bundle of sticks, right? And I think that in a lot of sense, that's true. Because, like, I think you can have rights to property, use rights, you know, and other things like that that aren't necessarily full exclusionary, physical exclusionary right to it, right? So the airport would have full physical exclusionary right to, you know, the physical airport itself. But having done that, they would have homesteaded an easement to a certain amount of noise pollution in the area. So if people come in, they can't then sue the airport and say, hey, we don't like you being so loud. What's like, okay, well, we were here before you. You knew what you were getting into. You bought a cheaper house because of the noise. Like, come on, you contracted in for this, right? But then he also says that where, like, if there was a residential area and then the airport came in, then they would be, you know, have to buy out the people or pay some damages for the noise pollution. So I think this is the same, similar kind of case. If you have some property and other people are around you, and if it's a peaceful air, if it's a peaceful nature area with a few homes along a road, then I would say that in a sense, over time, those people, you could argue that they've homesteaded an easement to a peaceful, quiet area, or, you know, something like that. So if somebody then comes in and starts renting it out to obnoxious people that he knows that they're going to be super loud, up all night, littering the place, you know, causing damage, destroying the naturic beauty of the land area, you know, I don't think that's unlibertarian. I think that you can say that people, in a sense, kind of homesteaded a type of easement to a type of, you know, general condition surrounding their homesteaded property. And I don't think there's anything unlibertarian about that. It's the same. I think it's indistinguishable from the airport example, which Rothbard fully endorses. So,
yeah. And as I was talking about before, I didn't do a lot of studying of Rothbard on his legal stuff, which is funny because I have a libertarian legal theory podcast. But anyways, putting that aside, then this is maybe where the problem is with the practicality aspect of Rothbard not being a legal professional. And that is where he talks about the burden of proof, which is another thing that we wanted to talk about.
Yes.
In practicality, a nuisance lawsuit is very hard to prove.
And he even points this out with, like, smokers, other, like, long-term chronic harms, losses, diseases caused by things like this, like pollution and stuff. That's very hard. And he's just kind of like, well, you know, tough, you know?
Well, yeah, I mean, see, but that's where I think it falls apart because...
Yeah.
Let's make a mental note to circle back and talk about shooting looters before we end.
Yeah.
If you can remember, cause I won't.
Yeah.
So on this end, basically Rothbard advocates, as Lysander Spooner did, for a proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard in all aspects. And I'm telling you right now, as a personal injury attorney, and we kind of touched on this in our episode on your podcast, was that I, you know, civil cases are judged by preponderance of the evidence standard, which basically means more likely than not. It's a 51%. Yep. So proving your case to 51%. I'm trying to think about how a nuisance case would go. You would have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the other person has been infringing on your bundle of sticks property rights. And that the cumulative evidence shows that it has, you know, I'm not familiar with the burden or with the legal standard, like the jury instruction for a nuisance case, but you would have to prove whatever that instruction is beyond a reasonable doubt with accumulation of evidence. And I mean, you would probably have to prove that it's constant enough to say that the value of your property is so adversely affected as to justify getting an injunction against someone to prevent them using their property in the way that they have a right to, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think that you put it in an interesting way. And I think Rothbard, he touches on it. And basically the idea is that in a civil case, the stakes a lot of the time are a lot lower, not always, but a lot of the times in a civil case, especially with you know, doing like automobile accidents and other things like that. I mean, in the grand scheme of the largest, the most paid trial lawyers of all time, you know, those cases are not, you know, World Trade Center demolition level of property damage stuff, right?
Yeah.
But so the stakes are a lot lower. And he talked
Moreover, though, sorry to interrupt, but
no,
the stakes for the plaintiff are so much higher. And I guess that's my point is that, you know, say you've been disfigured permanently. Any amount of damages is not going to make your face better, you know, or make it not happen anymore. On the other hand, the defendant, or more often than not, the defendant's insurance company is out a few hundred thousand dollars.
Yeah. Right. Right. So, yeah. And so I think that it's just kind of like the proportionality problem, right? I think it kind of ties into that. And the way you put it to me the last time we talked, it made me think of that, is that, you know, Rothbard does accept the idea of proportional punishment. Now he distinguishes that from self-defense when he talks about shooting looters and the fact that, you know, someone who comes into your house could get violent at any moment. You don't know who they are. You don't know what they're packing. So, you know, in that, you know, spur of the moment, heat of passion, whatever, you know, it's not so cut and dry. But once the guy's apprehended, once, you know, everything's going on and you have an actual process beginning in a court, punishment should be proportional. I mean, you don't send a guy who steals a stick of gum, you don't send him to the gallows. You don't lock him in solitary confinement until he dies, you know? So, it's just that, I think that the burden of proof kind of ties in with the proportionality, at least the way you kind of explained it to me and what I kind of understood what you were getting at is that what's proportional isn't just the punishment of being convicted, but what is proportional is how much evidence are we willing to accept to say that this is something that should have some remedy. And if it's a civil case, you know, if it's not murder or whatever, you know, like we were saying, I don't know. I think it makes sense that especially when the punishment is of a lower degree, that the burden of proof to evoke that punishment would be concomitantly proportionately lower. You know, I'm not sure. I can see the arguments from both sides, but I think that I don't think I'd toss that out entirely as Rothbard does.
Yeah. And I mean, one hypo that I'm thinking of is to go back to the looters example. I'm thinking of, I have a detached garage at my place now. And if I got up in the middle of the night and I saw lights on and I heard rustling around in the garage, can I go out with my Smith and Wesson and, you know, just turn the corner and blow away someone trying to steal my snowblower? I don't know if I can get on with that.
Yeah.
You know, granted, according to what Rothbard says, you know, it's not my livelihood at stake. You know, I could distinguish it from, you know, what we saw this last summer in a mob of people coming to steal your store that you don't have insured or that insurance won't cover.
Yeah.
Can I go out and blow away the guy trying to steal my snowblower? He also says, well, you don't know how far the invasion is going to go. I think there's a difference I can distinguish between someone breaking into my detached garage and someone trying to climb in through my son's window.
Yeah, yeah. I was just about to say, like, it gets into the deeper minutiae of the specific facts of the case. Like you said, did he break into your garage, which is not attached even to your home, or did he climb up a window? Did he... is it in broad daylight or is it in the middle of the night? Is it in a suburban area or is it in the middle of nowhere? I mean, all of these factors got to go in to, you know, considering whether or not, because I do think that if a guy, you know, like say, you know, the guy, and he said to you, I'm coming over tonight, I'm going to steal your snowblower. You know, it's like, you know, his plan, you know what he's going to do. If you know that, you know, he's not going to try to kill you, and then you blow him away anyway, I think that you defended yourself more so than what was justified, because you just, you know, stealing a chattel is not the same as killing you, because chattels can be replaced. Damages can be paid. Obviously, like you continually said, no remedy is complete. That's one of the things I teach in remedies class. No remedy is complete. Nobody is ever made whole because they had to go through all, you know, it's impossible. But you try to get them back as close as you can. And as close as you can, you know, it just means proportional. And so, I don't know. I think that if you, if somebody steals your gum or insults you and then you shoot them, you know, that's disproportional and you should be held liable, you know, beyond the extent that they aggress against you. And how do you decide that? You need the process and a good judge and a decent jury.
Do you think that I, in my hypo, do you think that I could go out with my Smith & Wesson and hold them at gunpoint and tell them to stop?
Yes, I think so, for sure. Absolutely.
But if we go back to Rothbard's example of the shop owner who shot the police officer, he does say in the paper that that would be an assault, or hypothetically, you know, holding a gun at someone and threatening their life would be considered an assault that would justify, you know, a defensive action situation. So if I pulled the gun and he was only stealing my snowblower, would he be justified in shooting me first to protect his own life?
No, I don't think so. Because you'll probably, I mean, this is getting into armchair zone, you know.
It is, yeah.
The hypotheticals get ever more complex. but if you know, if you say to him, hey, stop, freeze, don't move, you know, and you do a little, you know, your little click of the gun, you know, or if you got the shotgun, you know, crack it. Like, that'll get most people to stop moving real quick if they hear that, you know. But, you know, if you said something like that, like, hey, freeze, stop. No, don't move. Then I don't think they would be justified because you have signaled to them that, hey, I'm just going to defend myself and I'm not going to kill you if you don't, you know, move. But you're the trespasser. You're the one here, you know. And I think that in that moment, if they suddenly turned around and ran at you, you know, even if maybe they were running towards the door, which was the only point of exit, and you were standing between them and the door and they weren't trying to kill you, if they start running at you to get to the door, you don't know in that moment whether or not they're going for the door. They could be coming right at you. I think if you shot them then, you know, that's more likely to be acceptable. So I think that any invader in your home, any person who goes onto your property without your consent, even if it's totally innocent, I think you're totally justified in at least brandishing a weapon. But you got to be careful and you got to say, hey, look, freeze. This is private property. Who are you? What are you doing? You know, just going straight up and plugging them when, you know, someone's on your back farthing in a wooded area and they accidentally cross over your property without knowing it. You know, you probably shouldn't shoot them with a sniper rifle from your bedroom window. But if you came up to them with a gun and said, hey, what are you doing here? This is my property. Who are you? I don't think that's unjustified by any stretch of imagination.
Well, and to make it come full circle, this is what we were talking about in the beginning with common law precedent made off of positive law that Kinsella was talking about is like, because I'm thinking right now, well, okay, I believe Wisconsin is a stand your ground state. And if you have conceal and carry, you need to know, okay, when does the Castle Doctrine apply? And I'm pretty sure that it applies. I should know this like cold, but I'm pretty sure it applies anywhere in a dwelling on your property. Well, even like your garage or your driveway or something like that. So, well, so Dave, do we hit up everything that we set out to hit up?
Well, how far are we? How long have we been recording? I don't have a time.
We're about 103.
Okay. Let me see. I had a few other things I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, let's hit that up.
We can get to vicarious liability and respondeat superior next time.
That's going to throw me through a loop.
Yeah, but I definitely had some thoughts about that, so I'd like to get to that later. I actually wanted to ask you about, you brought up something about jury nullification to me, and I kind of wanted to ask you something about jury. I guess we can talk a little bit about jury nullification as such and kind of the idea you sent to me, but I had another question that I kind of wanted to ask you, so I kind of want to get to that first. I've been watching coverage of the George Floyd trial that's going on up in Minnesota. And
do they start opening statements?
I don't know. I think they're the last I heard, they were still selecting jurors.
Okay.
And that's what I wanted to talk to you about was you, because I kind of mentioned this earlier in the episode, there's like so much for me to learn not having practiced at all. So you actually having litigated a case, you know, actually having to go through like jury selection and stuff like that. I wanted to ask you, what do you think about voir dire? And I mean, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Is it contextual? I mean, is it like, does it depend on who's wielding that power? Because in the George Floyd case, I've been watching a few videos about the jurors, and I've seen some of the videos of the judge questioning the jurors and the different attorneys from each side questioning the jurors. And so, you know, I listened to a interview that Kinsella did with a guy named Daniel the Sexiest, and both of them said that they think that the jury selection needs to be random and no voir dire. It's just like you get 12 randos from the area and they're the jury, because there's just so much power in a prosecutor and or defense attorney being able to select who they allow on the jury and for what reasons. And so this is something that, to me, not having practiced at all, it's kind of beyond my understanding at this point in time, because I've never seen it work out in practice. So what do you think about all of that? I know that's kind of a convoluted intro.
No. Well, with the disclaimer that I've never actually participated in voir dire.
Oh, okay.
In my own jury trial, because I haven't done a real jury trial. I've done it in mock trial before.
Yeah.
I have tried 3 small claims cases in my repertoire. But going back, I would suspect that, I know that Kinsella has some misgivings with Lysander Spooner, but if you go back to the concept, and I just did it, I've been doing library exclusive episodes just for the sake of the audience. I've been doing one episode a day on library that I only release on library. And that is the YouTube Revolution channel. It's like a YouTube replacement evolution of it. So libertyweekly.net/LBRY will get you there. I did an episode on jury nullification in the context of the Derek Chauvin case, and this is what prompted the conversation between us. And I took a look at that, and, you know, the whole concept of trial by jury, as Lysander Spooner puts it, and he refers to the Magna Carta, is that it's a trial per país, which is a trial by the country. And what Dave is getting at is essentially this idea that it needs to be a random selection of the populace of a certain venue, because otherwise it's not a trial by the country. And maybe Rothbard would disagree with this man, that, you know, law is not supposed to be based on, or am I not understanding him that law is supposed to be normative, in that he says it shouldn't be based on custom.
He pushes back against that. And,
yeah.
That's another point that I'm not so sure I agree, because I think that there are a lot of cases where there are decisions, like I was just saying with like the tomato case that I was made before, like it's a completely non-normative decision of whether or not you live in a community that allows you to walk up to somebody's door and knock on the door, right? But
yes.
You know, it's like that gets to like contract, right? So it's like it kind of takes the problem back a step in the theory. So it's like, yeah, if you didn't contract for that, then it would be invasion, but if you did, then it wouldn't be. So, and then the question is just like, what did you contract to? And I think that part of that is custom, part of that is course of dealings, part of that is how do people normally operate in the area in which you're living. And if your contract did not specifically set that out, then we're going to assume that this is the way it works, and then you're allowed to present evidence that you decided that it would be something else. But the baseline, a lot of baseline rules, I don't think are normative, especially even in law. I mean, I think Kinsella calls them prophylactic rules, like rules that aren't necessarily required by the libertarian theory, but rules that over time people accept, they have some practical use, you know, and they can be different in different places at different times. So I do think that even when we're considering the normative aspects of law, you have to consider what custom and other things are going on at a place in time, because as I've just been saying over and over, what is aggression largely depends on, you know, what are the understandings of the people? What have you consented to, either explicitly or impliedly? And that's indispensable to making a normative conclusion in the case. So I think that throwing out all non-normative ideas from law is not practical. I don't think that can work. But I do still think that law is ultimately normative, because it is ultimately saying you have to do this, this, and that, right? So there is an ultimate normative basis there, but application is not the same as theory.
Well, and then again, you know, Rothbard talks about, especially in this paper, he's like, if it's the custom of a certain tribe to burn the virgin, you know, or something like that, that doesn't make it, you know, legal or anything like that. But I mean, more towards the nuance of it, in that hypo we were talking about, well, the real case where the shop owner is trying to fend off the crowd, the riotous crowd, and the police officer comes up and is shot. Well, what if, you know, the police officer made some kind of a hand signal, where in New York City that would mean, hi, I'm a friend, but in, you know, bumfuck Wisconsin, it means I'm about to kill you or something, you know? Yeah, so.
Well, yeah, also with the burning of the virgin example, I mean, I think the question ultimately goes back to, like, was that consented to? And the chances are that if you're burning a virgin in some, you know, savage tribe, they probably didn't consent to being burned at the stake. I mean, maybe they were propagandized, you know, et cetera. And that gets into a difficult situation. Oh. Like, did you consent because you were propagandized, right? And that's a problem too. And I think that it is possible, whether or not, you know, it is possible that you give your consent to something because you were propagandized. But ultimately the question is, did you give consent? I think as far as the law goes, that's the question. That's the ultimate issue, because you own yourself. So
do you believe there's such thing as unconscionability? So, for instance, I know we're really straying from your original question, and I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'm loving it.
It's organic. My question, so I got into there might have been a lot of alcohol involved, but last Christmas, I got into a huge argument, a good argument with another associate in the law firm, and he's more of a socialist type, but he was saying libertarianism cannot be, because it would support a system in which someone would be able to eat themselves, or like to cut off their arm and eat it. And I was trying to argue, you know, that, okay, well, they have self-ownership and we can't intervene, you know, the common libertarian line. But what do you think of this idea, is that if they want to eat themselves, that's prima facie evidence that they are not in their right mind and therefore not able to make that informed decision. Or you know, de facto, it's the fact speaks for itself. What is that? Res ipsa?
Res ipsa, loquitur, yes. That's interesting. I haven't thought about it like that before.
That would not get rid of the possibility that someone could have euthanasia. Because you could see, you know, someone in their right mind making that cost-benefit analysis.
Well, you know, I think in a lot of ways... See, this is the problem where I'm really trying to juggle like ethical, like normative decisions, and more just kind of like cultural, moral, less, you know, aesthetic decisions, right? Because it's like, I think it would depend on like, who's the court ruling on this, and why do they have jurisdiction over this situation? Why do they have jurisdiction over this guy? If this guy who's trying to eat himself joined some community and said, you know, I am subject to your jurisdiction, and if they were ruling on the case, you know, his wife or whatever, who doesn't want him to die, calls in and says, hey, you know, he's trying to kill himself, like, help me. And then, you know, if there was, you know, some ruling on whether or not he had that right, I think part of it would be, what are the rules of that community that he agreed to? And is cannibalism underneath that contractual arrangement, is that outlawed? Is that something that you're not allowed to do? And if you accept our jurisdiction and allow us to resolve your disputes, then this is the rule that you've agreed to. I don't have a problem with that at all. Now, if there was an outlaw, if there was some guy who had not assigned to some jurisdiction like that, right? And he tried to kill himself or eat himself, I think there would be no legal right to stop him. But the moment you come into civil society, the moment you agree to some community, and that's the libertarian social ultimate view, is that you contract with your community, right? That's the goal. So if you have that and there's some rule that you've contracted to,
then what's the, sorry to jump in, but according to the Rothbard-Evers contract theory, then what is being given up? What's the alienable property that he's pledged to get rid of? Or is the remedy, you know, if you want to do something that doesn't go, that doesn't abide by what the, like the commune or what the covenant community, what they've agreed to, what's the remedy then? Do you forfeit $10,000 or are you excommunicated and ejected?
I mean, wouldn't that just be set out in the contractual terms itself? I mean,
the liquidated provision, you know.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't you just say something along the line? Well, I think the alienable property would possibly be cash or, you know, bullion, some form of currency.
Bitcoin.
Yeah, it's just, you pay them and say, hey, look, I want you to be the court that, you know, I go to in cases of conflict. And so I think that's the alienable property that creates the contract. And then the terms of that contract, you know. So that's the thing for me, is like the difference between legal rules on, like, you know, without that kind of contractual superstructure of creating these communities and creating dispute resolution organizations on a market. And then you take it back a theoretical level to the homestead self-ownership principles that are the basis of that idea of contract that then we build social structures with. And I think that's ultimately the key Austrian insight of like how law needs to work and how we need to have a decentralized system of creation of law, because actual physical scarcity and control of property is always primary. I mean, you know, what some people have called economic property is always primary to legal property, which are not quite the same thing. You can control something but not have the legal right to it, right? But, you know, theoretically, when you're thinking about people, Crusoe always comes first, and doing what he wants to do on his island, that's how we kind of understand the basics of individual human action. And so Friday only comes later. So it's always, so theoretically, Crusoe and his economic property precede whatever legal system he might create with Friday to try to decide who can control what. So you know, the scarcity and physical property is primary there, but also just if you look at it from a sociological, historical perspective, you know, human beings were acting and using property and using tools and stuff before any government or court or legal system was erected. So both theoretically and in time, that always has to be primary before some legal property. And that's just the homestead principle. But whatever rules people construct from that, I don't think the normative kind of problem there applies quite the same way. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I mean, I wish that you were there with me when I was discussing this with the associate from my old law firm. All right. So to get back to your original question about jury selection and jury nullification, I think it's really interesting what Kinsella said about it, because he's right. You know, it should be a random selection. And if you're having, first off, if you're having the judge choose who the jury is, then you're getting rid of the randomness, because one of the big things they ask is, you know, do you believe in jury nullification? I mean, I don't know if you remember, Tom Woods had an episode about this a long time ago where he was on a jury and he told the judge that he believes in jury nullification, essentially that the jury has the right not only to judge the facts of a given case, but also to judge the law too. And that got him knocked off. So right there, you're doing a large selection against you know, what the jury is. But of course, we don't live in a Spoonerite society. So I've always said that you begin trying your case in voir dire, if not sooner. And in mine, usually, aside from selecting your jury, one of the most important parts of voir dire is to make the jury like you and to establish a rapport with them. Because most often, whoever wins the jury trial is primarily the attorney who tells the better story, and secondarily, the attorney that the jurists like more. And so, you know, in that sense of it, I don't know. So what was there more things you wanted to scalpel in on?
I guess, I think I was kind of linking it up to what Rothbard was talking about, because he doesn't specifically talk much about juries or jury nullification in this paper. But one of the things he does kind of say is, when he's talking about the burden of proof, he seems, and causation and evidence, he seems to be looking at the jury as a fact finder. And he seems to be looking at the judge as this, you know, this person who will lay out the libertarian theory of justice and the law, the libertarian law. And just kind of like what we were talking about before, with custom and other kind of things, context, social context of all that, the judge is often a middle upper class person within this society. And so to have the jurors come in being, you know, a wider net, they might have more insights and understandings about custom, about what was reasonable, about, you know, other things like that, that the judge might miss out on. And, you know, the judge might have a really good grounding in libertarian theory, but without those other considerations that those other people might have, you know, I think it's not a full view. So the idea of the jury being able to determine the law, it's very unwieldy, and it can be very dangerous. I mean, it can fall into you know, whatever bigotry or whatever, you know, founded or unfounded that the jurors might have. So I think there's a problem there, but I also think there's a problem in fully trusting a judge who themselves is from a certain segment of the society. They might not understand how things work within the context of this social circle that this case is about, right? And that's what the jurors bring in. And so having them be able to determine not only the facts but the law as well, I think there's something to that. So, you know, it's I don't think I fall on either side. I think it's a balance in the middle, and I think because it's kind of a balance, it's not the kind of thing that has a rote libertarian theory, Platonic, perfect answer to. I just don't think it does. I think this is an issue that it shouldn't fall radically on one side or the other, and I think it will probably fall on different positions on a gradient depending on the type of court, the type of community, you know. So Rothbard seems, I mean, I've never heard him say anything about jury nullification, but the framework he seems to be working with in this paper might seem to be totally against it, you know.
I think that's a great insight, and it's one of the big things that I grapple with in my criticisms of jury nullification, because, I mean, with my experience, juries, I don't like juries personally very much. I have a lot to criticize about juries, especially with their nature of globbing on to insignificant things. I don't trust juries to decide the proper law. Lysander Spooner also advocates in his piece that juries should be able to determine the rules of evidence. I mean, talk about something that's completely unworkable. And the whole concept of, and the reason why you're finding this really funny is because I know you probably just had evidence.
Yeah.
And you know about undue prejudice.
Yeah.
And I mean, not to be an elitist or anything, but juries are simple, common people. You just said this, and we just talked about the law being accessible, and I realized the irony of me saying this, but people glob onto things. I mean, you and I do it too. I guess it's not unique to common people, as I would say.
Yeah.
Sure. In quotes. But you know, people learn, oh, well, that guy, you know, he smoked weed once in high school, so therefore he probably was stealing. Or, you know, he smokes weed all the time, therefore he's stealing. Or this idea of completely facts that are not probative, which means they don't make something more or less likely. It's just a preconceived conception the jurors have in their mind. So absolutely not. The jurors should not be determining the rules of evidence. Neither should they understand what the law is, because they don't. They're not legal professionals. So I think that there's something to what Lysander Spooner is saying in the context of the state existing. Perhaps.
See, I think that's huge. I think that's always what it kind of comes down to, because the more I've kind of come through my legal education is that I think one of the points I've been getting to in this whole talk is that there are certain rules that, you know, maybe they're not the best or right rules, but it's just kind of like, it's that, geez, I lost my train of thought.
No, happens to me all the time. It's just, so what I advocate for then, Dave, is professional jurors. And this is what I would envision.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Come in.
Well, so, I mean, my idea, and this actually progressives have picked up on this too, but I think that in your case, either you would have an arbitrator or a panel of arbitrators, you know, I mean, if we want to follow along with the Anglo-Saxon, you know, the English common law version of the adversarial system, maybe you have one judge who determines the law and a panel of judges who determine the facts, or you have, you know, just a panel of judges that determines both. They know going into it what the rules of evidence are. They know the danger of undue prejudice. You know, and they don't have to charge a whole lot. And moreover, they're just like a libertarian judge would be. Everything is based off of precedent. So that's just my idea.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's an interesting thought. I just wonder exactly how it would operate, you know, in the specifics, but, you know, that's obviously a question that can never fully be answered. And even in real life, it would change day to day.
Yeah. Our best insight would probably be arbitration, you know, private arbitration that exists right now.
Yeah.
That'd probably be our best insight.
Which works pretty well.
Yeah.
It's a lot of money. I can tell you that. Your dough gets saved.
I know that, you know, a lot of legal professionals know this in their heart, but if that private arbitration and mediation system didn't work, the entire civil law system would fall apart tomorrow.
Yeah.
So I think the only reason it exists is out of pure necessity.
The court systems would be inundated.
Yeah.
They would collapse. They wouldn't be able to handle the workload.
And I hate to use that judicial economy argument, because so often it's used to justify the most statist bullshit ever.
Yeah.
But, Go ahead.
I remember the point I was
getting. Yeah, yeah.
Yes. So the point was that, like, with the state, there's a lot of doctrines that, like, I don't have a problem with them necessarily, other than the fact that it's the state that's choosing it and enforcing it. There's a lot of things that happen in the law where, you know, non-lawyer libertarians might look at it and be like, oh, you know, blah, 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 I don't like this. And it's just kind of like, if it wasn't the state that wasn't enforcing it, would you be okay with it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that there are a lot of rules that, you know, might be good for one situation, might not be good for another. The best way to figure that out is through a market discovery process. We can apply that to law. And, you know, with the state, that's the ultimate problem that I really see. I look at it very structurally. And I think that's one of the important insights that Austrian economics gives for law, is the structural analysis of how we decide the rules. You know, what's the process of picking the rules? And the ultimate rule itself, you know, a lot of the times I have less of a problem with the ultimate rule rather than having a monopoly state decide the rule, because you know that rule that they're deciding is going to be in their favor because they're a monopoly. But if it wasn't a monopoly and the same rule came out, I probably wouldn't have as much of a problem with it. So I think that's a good place to leave off, is just kind of like looking at it more structurally and realizing that, you know, there are certain rules that are not strictly ethical, strictly normative, but they arise in a decentralized manner on the market, and you can have a market for law. And even if they're not strictly, you know, ethical or normative, you know, there's still, you know, something that we agree to and come through. And if it's not through the state, I think it's legitimate. So I'll leave it off there.
Yeah. Well, that's great, man. And I mean, that kind of shed some insight on the whole, it's a private company, bro thing, but, I mean, as a disclaimer, man, I hope that personally, just for the audience, I hope that I didn't come across as too elitist when it comes to the law, because, you know, like, what we're both about is that people need to know about this.
Yes.
I mean, and we're trying to level that playing field.
The problem is that it's an unavoidable problem to a certain extent. It just is. I mean, no matter how much you try to describe something like this to somebody, it's like, I could have the best astrophysicist in the world come to me and describe it to me, and maybe he can put it to me in a way that I can understand and it can benefit my life and I can make some better decisions with it. But I'm not going to understand it to the level that he does, because he sunk his whole life into it. And that's just the same way it is with law. And law is particularly prickly because it affects everybody so much, even people who don't understand it. I mean, understanding computations and astrophysics does not nearly affect my life quite as much as it does with the specific law and the government getting into my business. But, you know, it's unavoidable. So we have to be cognizant of it, and we need to say that, look, yes, there will always be a certain amount of insulation and elitism, but we have to figure out a way to funnel it to the people that they can understand and make better decisions, and not fleece them. You know, honestly, that's the biggest problem, is the fact that people have to pay so much goddamn money to this system through taxes and lawyers and bullcrap, when it could just be so much more streamlined and efficient and get rid of unnecessary laws. That's the main thing. If you had less laws, even if people didn't understand those laws, it wouldn't be just as bad because there's less of them. So maybe we could focus our efforts on that. And libertarians all the time are trying to do that. So maybe that's the right balance.
And to what everyone, I mean, to that end too, it's like, well, we even said that Rothbard himself might have benefited from being a practicing attorney with his theories. So yeah, well, why don't you tell everybody where they can find your work?
Yeah. So, Law of Liberty podcast. I think we're on all the main, you know, we use Anchor. So, you know, Spotify, iTunes, whatever, you can find us there. We post on YouTube. You can find, at Law of Liberty Pod on Twitter. You can join the Discord. You can find that in our, different episodes descriptions, and follow Stratton too. He wasn't able to join us today, unfortunately, but Stratton is my co-host, so you can find him at StrattyD on Twitter, at Stratty Shrugged on Instagram, and you can follow his other podcast, Insurrection Inc., that he does with Porter and Jay. You can find them, and you can follow me on Twitter at Hoff Funk, HofffUnk. I don't post much libertarian stuff on my Twitter. I mainly just post videos of me playing guitar, but you know, whatever, maybe people will be interested in that, and maybe I'll post something libertarian every once in a while that people will enjoy, so you can follow me there.
Oh shit, well now we have like another hour and a half of things to talk about, because I didn't know you played guitar. Maybe we talked about that, but so do I.
I my mother was a master's in piano performance, and she was pregnant with me when she was doing her master's degree, so I kind of came out of the womb with a little chip on my shoulder of musical love and a little bit of talent, just a little bit.
Right on, man. Well, I always enjoy it when we talk, and you know, we're gonna have to schedule episode 2 discussing the rest of the paper.
Yeah, it's gonna be great. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you.
All right, right on. Thanks for coming on.